This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news, and joining us to discuss the stories affecting the tri-state this week are WCPO.com, WCPO insider government and political reporter Amanda Seitz, City Hall reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer Sharon Coolidge, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. Later in the show, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles will join us as we discuss the presidential and Senate races in Ohio. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Sharon, Amanda, and Howard, good to see everybody this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, Sharon, Cincinnati started rolling out body cameras for police officers last week. And I think they're starting with officers primarily in the Central Business District. And by the end of the year, there'll be 700 body cameras out there on police officers. But in the meantime, we have the FOP saying, no, wait a minute, we have some problems with this. And what are they saying?
That really came as a surprise. We have heard about body cameras for, you know, officially a year, but it seems like longer than that. There's pretty much no law committee that goes by without a discussion of it. And I know for sure the union, under different leadership, was involved in a lot of talk about the body cameras. And out of the clear blue we saw last week, the FOP sent a cease and desist letter to the city saying this has not been negotiated into our contract, something that's ongoing, and we're not going to wear them until we talk about higher pay for them and the policies. They really want to have all of this at the bargaining table.
So the timing of this, you mentioned that the contract negotiations with the police are ongoing right now. This comes up as an issue all of a sudden. Is this just part of the bargaining tactics that they're using?
I do think that they're really concerned about it. Everything's a bargaining tactic. But if you look around the country, we're definitely not alone in the union bringing up the issues they have with body cameras. It's really more the idea that it came at the last second. It's like, but you've known about these.
How much of this do you think is because of the fairly recent change in leadership at FOP?
I think definitely it has to do with that. I mean, the union membership, they had a vote. We had a FOP president, Kathy Harrell, for years, I think 6 years. And she really handled a lot of things and oversaw the beginning of this body camera implementation. But, you know, the union spoke out last December. They had a vote, overwhelming. They said, we want a new person to lead us as we go into wage negotiations, Dan Hills. And I think that has a lot to do with it. They're much more vocal about things they want.
You said an FOP lawyer sent out a cease and desist letter. Do we know at this point if anybody has ceased and desisted? Are they following that letter?
Honestly, I came across this when Harry put out a memo saying we're not ceasing and desisting. And I was like, ceasing and desisting from what? And that's kind of how the letter got exposed that they had sent to the city. They didn't really make like a big public fanfare of sending that letter. But Harry Black, you know, he spelled it out. He's like, I manage the police department. This is an administrative issue, and we're going to wear body cameras. And that's where we've left it.
Yeah, it sounds to me like, I mean, he's not going to back down on this in any way, shape, or form, negotiations or not. It does not have to be a part of a collective bargaining agreement.
Have other unions in the country been successful in getting more pay for wearing these body cameras?
I didn't see a lot. I didn't spend a lot of time doing this, but I didn't see a lot of resolution where the unions are getting involved. Only the fact that unions are getting involved. There's lawsuits, there's conversations. You can see a lot of stories like the union was saying this about body cameras and they're interested in this part of it. But I didn't really see like a lot of resolutions.
Are they making pretty much the same points the Cincinnati FOP is making? It's not that they're saying we object to body cameras. They're saying we object to it not being part of the collective bargaining process.
That's definitely the overwhelming thing that we're seeing, that they want to talk about the policy during collective bargaining. The higher pay issue was not as common in the other cities that I was looking at.
So as far as City Manager Black is concerned, though, he's saying I'm the city manager. I can do this if I want.
Yes. And additionally, I think one of the thought processes inside City Hall is this is part of policing in 2016. This isn't extra work. This is the work. And they really say it's no different than the cruiser cams that they've had for many years. They're just better cameras.
Well, have they actually listed specific reasons to justify the higher pay? I mean, what exactly extra duties are they saying are involved with the body cameras?
Well, they're saying the higher scrutiny, and that's certainly the case. I mean, these officers are going to be under watch, you know, by their bosses, by the public, and that is definitely an argument that's true. But whether they should be paid more for that is really where the sticking points come in.
And the higher scrutiny could be a good thing for them individually or a bad thing, you know, depending on the circumstances of various incidents.
Well, I think there are a lot of benefits to the higher scrutiny. It could vindicate you.
Oh, yeah. It could vindicate you or it could indict you. You know, I mean, it could go either way.
Certainly, that's what you see in, like, what the experts are saying and when you see, like, the think tanks come out and really talk about body cameras. But the police union at this point does not seem to be taking that direction with things. They say it's more work, it's higher stress, and they're not always a good thing. There's not been much conversation about, oh, yeah, there's pros and cons. They're talking about how much more work it's going to be and difficult.
Yeah.
So where do you think this is headed? I mean, does this end up in front of the court? Does it end up in front of the State Employee Relations Board at some point? Or do we have any ideas where it might end up?
Well, I suppose it could end up at NLRB or some place like that. You know.
So even at the national level, you're saying?
Well, yeah. I mean, any collective bargaining argument could go before the National Labor Relations Board.
There is a larger issue, which I know we're going to be getting to in a little bit.
Yeah.
And I feel like we're probably heading towards an outside resolution on the other issues related to wages. And I have a feeling that this will just be folded into that. Harry has offered to the union. He's like, well, we'll talk about that at the bargaining table. Well, there's no more talks at the bargaining table at the moment due to these other wage issues and the contention that's over those. And so I don't see anybody just sitting down on this one issue. They'll probably all be lumped into one, you know, fact-finding, arbitration. We're headed in the direction of outside resolution.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, in the meantime, Sharon, there's been more debate, as we're talking about contracts and pay raises, there's been more debate over Mayor John Cranley's proposal to give the city's union workers a 5% raise this year. I believe it's 5% next year and then 4% the year after that. And that's caused a lot of debate at City Hall. Councilmember Wendell Young this week, he actually was talking about opposing the mayor's plan, Howard, and what did he have to say?
Well, he filed a complaint against the mayor with the State Employee Relations Board, you know, which there's some question of whether or not he has standing to do that. Depends on which memo from the city solicitor you read. The one that went to him suggested that he might have standing, and the one that apparently went to the mayor said that he does not.
And
the problem with that is it's not up to the city solicitor. It's up to the State Employee Relations Board whether or not Wendell Young
bring the case or not.
They could just say, no, get it out, or, you know, and throw it out, or they could hear it.
Exactly. I saw those opinions come through on Monday. There were complaints filed over last weekend.
Right.
And then Monday there were dueling press conferences between Wendell Young and the mayor had his own press conference. But in the end, it doesn't matter what anyone thinks about if you have standing or not. The only person that matters is the State Employment Relations Board. And so we're just waiting to hear from them at this point on both of those.
Exactly. And you know, they're talking about when council comes back into session after Labor Day, actually voting on this package. You know, and he claims to have five votes for at least for the police and fire piece of this package.
So let's back up a little bit. Why did Cranley propose this in the first place?
Well, he's saying, you know, there's been years of recession and that these wages are deserved. And there's definitely some talk about what they need to be paid. There's very fair arguments. The question is the timing of things. And in fact, no one, I don't think, in City Council disagrees that they should get these wages.
Right.
But we just had the budget pass in June, just a few months ago. And this could have easily been put in there if everyone thought that this is what was needed. And yet it never came up really, except, you know, just 3% raises and 1.5% raises, depending on your union.
Yeah. And then there's this argument about the responsibility for giving raises to employees and who negotiates those. Are those negotiated by the city manager, or is it just something that the city council can say, okay, yeah, fine, you know, we've got a majority for 5%, and here it is. The city charter makes it very clear that the city manager has responsibility for negotiating contracts with public employee unions, period. And if we're going to do it this way, we're basically saying this charter that we've had for nearly 100 years now no longer applies in this case.
Well, and didn't Wendell Young make that? He made it very clear that he was not against pay raises.
He's against the process.
He's not against suggesting.
He's not against the pay raises. He's not against the unions. All, as Sharon said, all of these council members, I think, would agree that these people deserve raises. It's just a matter now of how it's going to be done. Is council going to do it by itself? Is the city manager going to negotiate this in collective bargaining agreements? That's the question.
And the answers become very political.
Right.
Not voting for these it's not looked on well during an election.
Well, yeah.
On some level, that's the argument that Cranley's critics have made, that purposely put his opponents
put in a tough
in
spot.
That position. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, he's putting them in a bad spot where he's trying to force them to vote against raises for public employees. And in the process, they would be angering the unions. And we're going into an election year next year. And so these people on council are very sensitive to those arguments. And that's why Wendell Young made it very clear that his argument was not about the raises. He supports unions. He supports contract negotiations. He supports giving these people more money. He just is opposed to the process that John Cranley is proposing.
You think from a taxpayer standpoint, though, Howard, that a lot of taxpayers, the question wouldn't be, do they deserve it? A lot of taxpayers, well, sure they deserve better wages. The question, I think, I wonder if a lot of taxpayers don't have this question: can the city afford it? The question I have is, what does this do to the city budget over the next few years?
Yeah, and I think that's interesting, because that's not really what we've seen from the argument that's played out at City Hall. It has become more about the process, how it has been carried out. And I mean, that's kind of the argument we've always seen from the critics, going back to parks last year, right? I mean, they said, we love our parks, but we don't like how the mayor executed this process. So I think that's kind of how the argument tends to play out with these things.
So Chris Bingham, the council, they had like one weekend to like really look at this plan, and that was their first question: can we afford this? And you know, the answer was that this is going to create a shortfall in upcoming years. But the truth of the matter is, city council can afford anything they want to afford. It could mean, unless there's higher revenues, that could mean cuts elsewhere. But those are decision-making processes that will come in those out years. The city can afford it next year. But going forward, even if there is a shortfall, those budgets aren't set yet. And so any shortfall could be offset with, you know, saving money somewhere else.
Has the mayor come out yet, Sharon, and said, this is how I would fund this in the next few years?
He has not, mostly, I think, because a lot of it has, you know, focused on the process. But he has made that point. Like, well, we'll look at it when those budgets come up.
And we will continue our conversation about local news, our review of local news, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email us, talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us for a review of the week's local news, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Government, and political reporter Amanda Seitz, City Hall reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Sharon Coolidge, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So Wendell Young filed his unfair labor practices complaint. I guess, again, the question with that is whether he has standing to do that or not. In the meantime, City Manager Harry Black's also filed an unfair labor practices complaint over the pay raise issue. And Sharon, can you tell us what he's addressing in that complaint?
The city manager is talking about that his complaint is against the union, and he's suggesting in his complaint that the union is not bargaining in good faith and really talking outside of to the public, to the scope of things that they're allowed to do. And you know, the mayor has commented on that, saying this is free speech. The union has a Facebook page where they've been very vocal about what they're asking for and why they're asking for it. And some of those very contentious Facebook posts were attached to the complaint.
And of course, when we're talking about this bypassing of city administration, there was a case, North Olmsted, I think, that a lot of people have talked about in the press that said the Firefighters Union in North Olmsted tried to go around city administration directly to city council, and they got penalized for doing that. So I think a lot of the critics of this, that's what they're doing. They're pointing to North Olmsted and saying, well, that's the precedent.
Yeah, they are. And the reason is because the city has a city charter which lays out what how negotiations are done, and they are done through the administration, not through the legislative body, not through elected officials.
The most interesting thing about the North Olmsted case was, you know, a phrasing that the employment board used, which is, you can't go around the process because it creates chaos. Mm-hmm. They used the word chaos, and now a lot of people are like, see? Chaos.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the word that Wendell used over and over again in his press conference about it.
The other thing I do want to point out about this entire process, and David Mann made this point, Councilman Vice Mayor David Mann, made this point very early on in the process, because the question was, do you think CERB complaints need to be made over this? And he said, no, because where would that get us? Even in the North Olmsted case, if you look back, they're like, don't do this. Well, okay.
Yeah, right.
That's hardly a sanction, or, you know, I think he really wanted to see things resolved internally instead of having to go to the state.
Yeah.
Now, haven't two of the city employees unions just recently gotten new contracts, Sharon?
They did. And honestly, when we saw the fire contract settled first at 3%, everyone was super happy. That was good news. We thought it was going to be smooth sailing the rest of the year. And that was not to be. But the two contracts are negotiated, and what's suggested now goes outside of that, is higher, and meaning that they'll have to be opened back up and put the new terms in.
Oh, so this could send that
whole thing
back to the drawing board.
Oh, yeah.
513-419-7100 to join us, and Dave in Pleasant Ridge joins us now. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Well, I guess, my comment is that it strikes me that the collective bargaining process has gotten both pretty craven and pretty cynical here. Cynical on the mayor's part because he's willing to bribe the police union to, you know, give up their rights to negotiate. And for its part, the police union seems to be willing to be bribed for a slight increase in wages.
I don't think they see it as a slight increase. I will say they feel like their members are underpaid. That was an issue when they were voting on a new union president, and it's long been an issue. So they would not consider what's going on right now over something like a slight pay raise. They feel like they are unfairly compensated. They've offered a lot of numbers comparing themselves to other departments. And if you look at the comparison numbers, you know, they are paid less than other departments. And then the city manager, of course, fires back and he talks about, well, our unions have gotten other things, schedules they like, and different kind of things in their contract. And so no contract really is apple to apples.
Yeah. So, do we know how the city's police, how their pay compares to other cities?
You have to trust the union numbers at this point. As far as I can tell, no independent media look has happened to call the departments. But again, it's very difficult. Departments have different ranks. They have, you know, they treat their employees different in academies. There's so many nuances to police contracts and the different ways they get paid. Are they on extra hours? Are they, you know, motorcycle officers?
Right.
There's a lot of different things. And so there's no way to call up and be like, is it, if this is your starting pay, there's always like, yeah, but.
Right. Yeah. Do they budget for overtime, you know, for police officers, that kind of thing? I mean, they, you know, it is apples to oranges. It's very difficult to compare one city to another.
And Howard, you were saying that there's likely not to be a vote on Cranley's plan until after council comes back in September. And
well, that's what Cranley said. I mean, he expected a vote.
He thinks he's got the votes to pass this, doesn't he?
What he said was that he believed he had 5 votes for the raises for police and fire, and that he had 4 votes for all of the unions, you know, the other 3 unions that are involved, AFSCME, Code, and Building Trades. So, you know, that's where it stands. That's where it stood the other day. I don't know where it stands today, you know, if whose arms are being twisted or.
The council members they're not really not saying. I think they're all still trying to figure out, you know, their position on things. I can't tell what the votes are, but I will say, you know, city workers talk to each other. And if there's not 5 votes for everything, it's going to breed a lot of
disgruntlement. Right. Yeah. And that's what I think, you know, that's what he's worried about. He needs 5 votes for everything, the whole package.
Mark in Bellevue joins us now. Hi, Mark.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. Go right ahead.
So I just wanted to make sure that it's clear. I actually work for AFSCME Ohio Council 8, not for the city union, but with other unions. One thing that was said is it made it sound like the contract was going to be completely reopened. That's not even what is at all being proposed.
Right now that they have the contract, if this pay raise plan goes through, that it would cause the other contract to be reopened. And you're saying that's not the case.
Well, no, it would only the only provision that would be opened under this would be wages specifically. Anytime a contract is open, it can be opened by mutual agreement.
Mm-hmm.
If you mutually agree to open up one specific part of a contract, then it's only that part of the contract that's opened up, and that's all that's being proposed here for every single union.
That's absolutely true.
Mark, thank you for the clarification. We appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about something, the streetcar. It's got a new name.
It does have a new name, the Cincinnati Bell Connector. Big news last night.
Cincinnati Bell Connector. So it's got a new name. Does that mean a new color scheme or a new look for the streetcars?
Well, certainly Cincinnati Bell has a different look than what the streetcar currently looks like. So,
yes. Yeah, I guess, I mean, they're going to have to repaint the whole thing, you know, have a new logo and that sort of thing.
So far, they haven't showed us, like, a rendering or anything.
Okay. Yeah.
They have said new colors. And if you look at Cincinnati Bell, if you pull up their website, you see their logo and you see very pretty green and blues. And when we talked to Amy Murray, the councilwoman in charge of Transportation Committee last night, the first thing she said is, it won't be Steelers colors anymore. And so I think that was a huge indication that we're going to see a change in what the streetcar looks like.
Oh, yeah. What's this worth in terms of dollars? What's the whole deal worth?
Huh? You know what? Honestly, if you take a look at the money, it's worth what they said it was going to be worth. It's worth $3.4 million over 10 years, and that's always what they were projecting. It's not open yet, and that's, they got a little bit more than that. That's the money that did come in with this.
Right. And the company, though, that negotiated this deal with Cincinnati Bell gets their cut, too.
Advertising vehicles.
Right.
They're the second company that was brought in to try and work on advertisements. The first company did not do a very good job. And so this company came in, has a contract with Sorda, and they negotiated a 38% commission. But they do kind of doing some research on this this morning, they don't just go out and get the ads. They create the ads. They install the ads. Somebody writes graffiti on the ads. They fix the ads. So it's much okay. more work than just going out and getting the advertising.
Yeah. But so it's not just a straight commission for signing a contract. They have actual work to do.
They do. And I'm assuming that it includes, you know, they really do have to keep these ads up. You can't let them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So Cincinnati Bell Connector.
Cincinnati Bell Connector.
Okay.
Do you think anyone will actually transition over to that? Or, think it'll be hard to.
Yeah. I don't know. It'll
one
of those
things.
It'll
always be the streetcar to me. So
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never really called it the Cincinnati streetcar. I've always called it
the streetcar.
Street
yeah. Right. Yeah.
But for Cincinnati Bell, I had the opportunity to go to Kansas City when they opened their streetcar earlier this year. And really, an enduring memory when you look at their streetcars is they have a deal. It's more like an advertising deal. 4 months, they're wrapped in Sprint logo. Like, that's the takeaway from their streetcar. When you look at it, you're Sprint.
And it doesn't matter what they call it as long as people see Cincinnati Bell, you know, mm-hmm. and the other advertisers as well, who are going to be plastered all over the inside and the outside of the streetcars, and the streetcar stops.
A lot of that, too, is related to what's along the stops.
Right.
We see Rheingeist, you know, they have a stop right in front of the
Taste
brewery.
Taste of Belgium.
Yeah, so businesses along the route are what you're going to see inside the streetcar, Richter and Phillips.
Right.
Well, Sharon, thank you for joining us this afternoon. City Hall reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Sharon Coolidge, and coming up, Howard Wilkinson, Amanda Seitz, and Ohio Public Radio's Joe Ingles will join us for a look at how the Senate and presidential races are shaping up in Ohio. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Only, and correct me if I'm wrong, Howard, I think it's only 80 days until the November election. That sound about right to you?
That's right.
Yeah. Amanda says yes. She's been counting.
Yeah. I counted us up a little earlier today. I can't remember if it was it 80 or something.
I think it depends
82.
On if you're counting the day or not. Right. Or, yeah. You know.
I actually, what I found was a clock that was online. You can actually look this up, days until the election, and it says it's very specific. 80 days, 14 hours, 30 seconds
weeks.
When I looked.
Basically 12 weeks minus 3 days, whatever that is.
Well, joining me now to take a look at the presidential and Senate races in Ohio, WCPO.com, WCPO insider government and political reporter Amanda Seitz, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Joe, welcome to the conversation. Glad to have you here this afternoon.
Well, it's great to be here.
Now, Joe, what's the latest polling show? Let's talk about the Portman-Strickland race. What is the latest polling showing on that particular race?
Actually, the latest polling is showing that Portman has kind of pulled ahead of former Governor Ted Strickland. Now, I really caution, though, when we get too far into this polling at this point of the game.
And we're still 80
really
days out. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot can change. And, you know, one of the things that you know, doesn't necessarily show up in the polling is, you know, we see on the Republican side that a lot of Ohioans, we know, are not happy with the candidate that's been chosen for president. Ohio voted for John Kasich to be in that spot. And still, if you talk to a lot of Republicans, they're just, you know, kind of lukewarm on their presidential candidate. And with that being the case, you know, these pollsters may be calling people and asking, you know, who do you prefer? And they might be saying Portman, but, you know, if this is someone who is not really committed and behind the presidential candidate, will that person actually show up at the polls? That remains to be seen.
That's...
Now, they're trying really hard, but I just caution about polling at this point in the game when we've got this huge factor out there that we don't know how will play out.
Right. Joe is absolutely right, totally right on that. This explains why Portman's campaign has done things like send people into the crowds at Hillary Clinton events in Ohio to work the crowds and you know, pass out literature and try to get votes from Hillary Clinton people who, you know, may not be convinced, you know, who may be convinced to vote for the Republican in the Senate race, even though they're committed to Hillary Clinton in the presidential race. And they're targeting, and they told me this months ago, the Portman campaign, that they were targeting in their phone bank operations and their door-to-door operations, targeting Hillary Clinton voters who might be persuaded to vote, split the ticket, and vote for a Republican for U.S. Senate.
Yeah, and I just think the biggest thing in this race is who turns out to those polls.
Exactly. And we don't know that yet.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly, though, Republicans are putting together a very nice ground game for Rob Portman. I mean, if you talk to Cincinnati Republicans, too, I mean, I've spoken with some that, hey, they're not thrilled about Donald Trump. They're going and knocking doors, but they will talk up Rob Portman. So I think that's, you know, his ground game is very strong. And I think it's being noticed across the country, really.
And let's not forget that $36 million of dark money that's been thrown in for Portman, you know, basically, in this election. That's having some impact, too, it appears.
Yeah, that's having an enormous impact, I think. You know, you look at some of these polls, and I kind of tend to agree that the Quinnipiac poll had a 9 percentage point lead for Portman over Strickland. I think that's probably an outlier, and that David Pepper, when he talks about, well, it's probably more like 3 or 5%, he's probably right. That it is somewhere in that range that Portman has that kind of a lead at this point. But as we say, this is, you know, still a little over 11 weeks away, and that's an eternity in politics, an absolute eternity.
Well, Rob Portman normally helps the GOP presidential candidate by get ready for the debates by playing the role of the Democratic Party's candidate.
Well, don't expect that.
He's not doing that this year. Yeah. Yeah. You read anything into that?
Well, what I read into it is that, I mean, he obviously, you know, Rob Portman's in a difficult situation. He has said on various occasions, and you've heard him say it, I've heard him say it, Joe's heard him say it, I support Donald Trump, the nominee of my party. But he doesn't want to be seen with him, and he won't be seen with him. I can guarantee you between now and November 8th, you will not see the two of them in the same place at the same time at any kind of event in the state of Ohio.
Instead, he is showing, you know, he's excited about his support from John Kasich. I mean, he's going around the state with John Kasich.
Touting John Kasich, who is opposed to Donald Trump. And, you know, still it refuses to endorse Donald Trump for president and, you know, says it's a matter of principle. But John Kasich has spent his time with Rob Portman and with other congressional candidates, Senate candidates, and even House candidates around the country trying to help get them elected and just thumbing his nose at Donald Trump.
Right, right. And one thing that we've got to remember here is the makeup of Ohio. Ohio, I like to say it's a purple state, despite the fact that right now we have a Republican governor and pretty much Republican everything across the board. That's not really it doesn't really indicate who Ohioans are. Ohioans are known to go across the aisle, elect Republicans and Democrats. And with that being the case, being a moderate in Ohio is actually a good thing when you're playing in a general election.
Yes. That's why I think really Portman's made the best out of the situation that he could, because he's just kind of walking that very fine line and not jumping in either way.
Right. Yeah, and it's a difficult balance that he has to strike. You know, he doesn't want to alienate the Trump people, the people who are going to come out and vote for Donald Trump.
Because he might pick up a few votes.
Because he'd pick them up.
From those.
He wants some of their votes, particularly in eastern Ohio, southeastern Ohio, you know, the Mahoning Valley, those kind of places, where he might have some trouble because of his record on trade issues. But, you know, he's walking a very fine line, and so far he's done a fairly good job of it. You know, he's kept his distance, but he's managed to say, okay, yes, I do support this nominee of my party. He wasn't my first choice, but I accept it.
Have the two set any set a debate schedule yet, Joe? Mm-hmm.
Yes, they do have three debates coming up. One will be in Cleveland, I believe. The other one's in Cincinnati. And
No,
Cleveland. We have Columbus, right?
Youngstown.
Which again goes to Howard's point about exactly. that eastern part. I mean, it's interesting how much Youngstown
the
of all places
Valley
has played
very
in this election.
Important.
That's right.
Yeah.
But no, that's one of the very noticeable omissions that Cincinnati is not going to have a debate. You know, Rob Portman is from here. Ted Strickland has represented in Congress areas just east of here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, both of them are fairly well established, you know, in southern Ohio, but they're not going to have a debate here.
I don't, you know, I've been kind of surprised by the lack of campaigning we've seen, from the uh-huh. Senate.
I'm glad it's not just me, because I kept thinking, is it my imagination? People just aren't showing up in Cincinnati as much.
I have to say, right. as a political reporter, it's a little disappointing in an election year. But, yeah, I definitely think there's been not as much emphasis.
Look, Hamlin County is going to be important. It always is. You know, it's one of the key counties in a key swing state. But I'll tell you the truth. I think, you know, the two areas that are going to decide the election are Franklin County and Central Ohio. And then when you go up into the Mahoning Valley and some of eastern Ohio, and you know who can grab hold of voters and get them out to the polls in those areas, that's going to make the difference not only in the presidential race but in the Senate race as well.
Yeah, I'd like to point out too that some areas of central Ohio, for example, Delaware County, which is north of Columbus, that has been reliably red. That is always, almost always red. And right now there is kind of a, if you go up there and you go to the Republican Party headquarters in Delaware County, the last time I was by there, they didn't have a Trump sign out. Very absent. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the Republicans up there have said, you know, and remember, Governor Kasich is from Delaware County, by the way. But, you know, a lot of the Republicans up there are saying, hey, you know, we really just can't get behind Trump. And if you have that in one of your most reliably red counties, if that sticks and they don't get behind Trump, you have to wonder what impact that will have on this election as well.
Yeah, Joe, I know you're very familiar with Delaware County, and those Republicans in Delaware County are not the kind of folks who came out and voted for Donald Trump in a primary.
Right.
They just aren't.
Right. They were Kasich Republicans.
They're absolutely Kasich Republicans. More middle of the road, you know, they're conservative, obviously, but not, you know, to an extreme extent.
Right.
Joe, do you see a lot of excitement for Hillary Clinton in Cleveland and other areas that are typically Democratic in Ohio, or is there concern over her problems that she's facing, her missteps?
Well, you know, honestly, I'm not seeing a lot of excitement over anyone. What I'm hearing the most when I go out is we're sick of politics.
Right.
We're sick of this election.
Can't we just get this
over
with?
Yeah. And they don't, you know, people tell you, they'll be straight up, well, I wish so-and-so would have run, or I wish we had a better choice. I think if we had none of the above on the as one of the choices, I think none of the above would probably win this one, from what I'm seeing from people I talk to.
And one of the things that's happened in recent years in Ohio politics, and we've always talked about Cuyahoga County as this great Democratic stronghold, and it is to a certain extent, but the ratio of Republicans to Democrats is much more even now than it used to be. You know, it used to be like it was 5-1. Five Democrats for every one Republican. Now it's more like 1.5 Democrats for every Republican in that county.
And I think that's why you're seeing, too, I mean, although the polls are not at all reliable really this year.
No.
But you're seeing still Ohio is really still a close call in single poll, where you've seen swing states like Florida, where Hillary Clinton started to take a bigger lead, like Pennsylvania. You don't see that here in Ohio.
And I don't think we will, because Ohio is just not – Ohio has become, as Joe says, a purple state, and elections are going to be close in this state. You know, there are not going to be runaways in Ohio in any time in the foreseeable future, and there haven't been in the recent past either.
And I want to go back to the Strickland-Portman race. Ted Strickland had a tough stretch. He was making a speech to the AFL-CIO in Cleveland, where he talked about the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, and he said it happened at a good time because it caused the high court to deadlock 4-4 in a case that could have gone against labor. And he was roundly criticized for saying that Justice Scalia's death happened at a good time. He got a lot of criticism for that, and he's since apologized. And I'm just wondering, Joe, from what you're seeing, has that hindered Ted Strickland and his campaign? Has that sidetracked him in any way?
Not from what I'm seeing. I hear a lot of political types talking about that. And certainly, you know, Rob Portman's campaign has talked about it. But if you go out and, you know, again, talking to real people, I think that's not something that really made a huge mark, like some other things that, you know, they're more likely, real people are more likely to talk about real issues.
Yeah.
And honestly, neither of the candidates are really hitting home. I don't hear anyone saying that candidate really is speaking my language. I don't hear that when I go out.
Well,
now, maybe there are people out there like that, but that's not what I'm hearing.
Both of them are so not known throughout the state, too, is probably part of that issue as well. I mean, they're not that widely known in the state.
Well, yeah, that's a particular problem, I think, for Portman. When you look at polls that say anywhere from 30% to 40% of Ohio voters don't know enough about him to form an opinion, either favorable or unfavorable. That's not really good for a sitting United States senator. You know, you want to be well known. Now, governors are a little bit more well known, so you know, Strickland's numbers along those lines are a little bit better, but the Portman campaign has painted him as this failed governor, retread Ted, cost Ohio 350,000 jobs. I mean, it's, you know, great
it's
stuff.
It's not a great thing to be known for.
Right. It's not good to be known for, and it makes for like a good 30-second TV commercial. Retread Ted, lost 350,000 jobs.
Is that why Ted Strickland, in his first TV ad, he spent more time telling who he was, where he was from? The ad's more about him. Never mentions Portman in the ad. Is that what he's trying to do, is to get people to know him better?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's common in a campaign, that they do an introductory ad, you know, saying, okay, look, here's who I am as a human being. Here's where I came from. Here's my background. And then they start getting down and dirty as the campaign goes along. And also the fact that, you know, there's so much independent expenditures and dark money out there that can be spent to do the dirty work for not only Ted Strickland, but for Rob Portman, for any candidate, that they don't have to be mean and nasty on their own commercials. But, you know, I'll make one other point about Strickland. Strickland, you know, is being beat over the head with his 350,000 jobs lost. His only argument that he can make is, look, I was governor when a worldwide recession began, a recession that crippled this entire country, and all 50 states lost jobs during that period of time. Said, I didn't start that. That was not my fault. And I did everything I could as governor to try to combat it. That's a much more difficult argument to try to make in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think there's another point to that that you kind of add on to that, Howard. And it's the fact that he could go back and look at the numbers. And if you look at the numbers in Ohio, actually jobs started to come back under the end of his administration.
Right.
And there was that huge amount of stimulus money. I'm trying to think, well, what was it, $6-8 billion? Mm-hmm. I can't even remember the number now. But it was a huge amount of money. And Strickland basically put that right back into saving jobs and put it back into the government to balance the budgets. And he didn't, you know, some of these states, you know, they threw it in a rainy day fund or they did other things. There were decisions made at that point when they got that stimulus money. And it didn't ramp up the... It turned out that because we didn't have that huge job loss, then the skids were just greased when Governor Kasich came in. They were already, you know, going toward that direction.
Oh, absolutely.
And Governor Kasich just propelled it further. So I think he could make that point, but he's not.
Yeah, he could make that point. And everything you said is true, but you can't say it in 30 seconds.
That's right.
And then Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, they're going to be making appearances in Greater Cincinnati in the next few weeks?
Yes, they'll be here for the American Legion convention, which starts on August 26th at the convention center here. I mean, that's kind of a traditional event that presidential candidates are invited to and, generally speaking, attend.
They'd be going if it was in North Dakota or Cincinnati.
Yeah, right. It really doesn't matter where it is. I mean, it's you know, one of those things that, yeah, you do that. You go to the American Legion convention.
And Amanda, let's spend a few minutes talking about the Hamilton County Commission race. You wrote an article about this at WCPO.com. This is between Dennis Dieters and Denise Driehaus.
Yes, this is the race to be watching if you're a Hamilton County political junkie, as many people are, I'm sure. Yes, it's two well-known names really going up against each other. You have Denise Driehaus, who her family comes from a long line of politicians, and same with Dennis Dieters, whose brother is the Hamilton County prosecutor, well-loved and popular.
Yeah, and both these candidates, the people have pretty good impressions of them, I take it. They're both respected.
Yeah, Denise is a state house representative. She's been reelected to all of her bids for that seat. Dennis was a Coleraine Township trustee and just took over the seat after Greg Hartman left on the Hamilton County Commission. So it's going to be a very close, interesting race to watch. Some have speculated that it could be the most expensive county commission race in the history of our commission seat. It is so important because they are truly battling out to control. The Democrats and Republicans are battling it out to see who will control the commission. The county commission, which has long been Republican held, but that could change this year.
Now, what are the issues? What are the big issues in this race?
So when I talked to them last week, obviously the sewer will be a really big issue for both of them. The Republicans see it.
So MSD is one of the big, okay.
Yeah, the sewer district. You know, the Republicans kind of look at it, hey, we don't want to hand over the sewer district to the Democrats because the city is Democrat-led, and doing so would further cause issues and lack of oversight of this huge district. Whereas the Denise Driehaus is really playing up the idea that, hey, I will work really well with city council on this issue, elect me. I know another issue that Dennis has brought up is the heroin issue as well, that I know he'll hit hard on. It makes sense for him to do that as well because his brother is a prosecutor, kind of playing really hard at that, the community policing, those police issues, those types of things.
But you think this is the local race to keep an eye on?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's where, that's where both of the parties are investing all of their money and time.
Right.
And for more on politics, Ken Rudin and Howard Wilkinson will be on our September 1st show, so we'll have more political talk then. And in the meantime, thank you so much, Joe, Amanda, and Howard, for joining me this afternoon.
Great to be here.
Thanks.
WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Government and Political Reporter Amanda Seitz, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Reporter Joe Ingles, and WVXU Political Reporter Howard Wilkinson. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. And Dave Shermer was our technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Science Friday coming up next on 91.7 WVXU. Robert Kennedy is remembered as a racial healer, a defender of the poor, and a progressive champion. But Kennedy's political journey began in the conservative 50s. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll talk with author Larry Tye about his new book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. We'll also hear about the new Cincinnati Brewing Heritage Trail, designed to preserve and celebrate our beer brewing history. That's Cincinnati Edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.